Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. My co-hosts this week are public safety reporter Naomi Martin. Hey, Naomi.
Hi, Tristan.
And federal courts reporter Kevin Krause.
Hello.
Austin Bureau reporter Tom Benning will join us by phone momentarily to talk about guns on private college campuses, or the lack thereof in this case. We'll also talk today about butt injections, which is Naomi's specialty. And we'll talk about child porn comics. So, exciting show for you today. We'll end today's show with another Hashing It Out with Mike Hashimoto. But for now, Tom Benning, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom, you wrote a story this week about campus carry and how private universities are opting out of sort of the open carry law and the campus carry law. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, first, just a point of clarification there. Open carry and campus carry are totally
right.
Separate things.
My apologies.
And, no worries. But that is a point of confusion that a lot of folks have. Even when open carry becomes law in January, you will not be allowed to do that on a college campus. So we'll get that out of the way first and foremost. But, yeah, with the campus carry law, which goes into effect for four-year schools next fall, so much of the attention has been on public colleges and universities and the rules that they're in the process of making in terms of creating some gun-free zones. But somewhat overlooked in that conversation has been the fact that private colleges and universities still have the authority to completely opt out of campus carry, completely ban guns on campus, and that's because they're private property. Even a lot of pro-gun, very staunch pro-gun Republicans, that was a bridge too far to start messing with private property rights. And so just this past week, TCU became what appears to be one of the first, if not the first, school in Texas to say, announce its policy, which is that no guns will be allowed on campus.
What, have any other colleges said that they're going to allow this?
Well, not that I'm aware of. Most of the private schools, SMU, for instance, or the University of Dallas, their existing policy is that weapons are banned on campus. But we're kind of in playing the waiting game right now because part of the law says that even for private schools, you have to consult with your students, faculty, and other stakeholders to kind of get a sense of what sort of feeling there is towards this idea on campus. But it seems that most of the private schools would probably lean towards maintaining their no-gun policies. As far as the public schools go, only Texas State University has even gotten as far as issuing a draft recommendations from a working group. So we're still probably weeks, more likely months, until the actual policies come into focus for public schools.
And the public schools are going to, what's happening at the public schools?
Well, so it's kind of a fascinating policy debate that's happened since the law was passed. The campus carry bill passed late in the session after a compromise was made to give the public schools a little bit of discretion, someone say a lot of bit of discretion, to create gun-free zones on campus. But the lawmakers didn't give a lot of specific guidance. They said you can establish, quote, reasonable rules, but you can't establish anything that generally prohibits or has the effect of generally prohibiting guns on campus. So what we're seeing now is trying to figure out what that means. And one particular flashpoint has been, are guns allowed in class? A lot of professors, particularly at UT Austin but elsewhere, have said, we don't want guns in our classrooms. If you can't ban guns in all classrooms, allow us to decide if we want to do that in our classroom. Well, the author of the campus carry bill, Senator Brian Birdwell, has been pretty adamant that that should not be allowed. Campus carry opponents such as Trey Martinez Fisher, a San Antonio Democrat, says the schools can do that if they want. The law doesn't say that they can't. And then the Republican who authored the amendment that established that language about reasonable rules, he's kind of taken a more nuanced approach, saying, well, maybe, I wouldn't be happy with a blanket ban on guns in class, but maybe there are some classes where that's not a comfortable setting, where maybe the topic's particularly divisive or political and things like that. So it's kind of, it'll be interesting to see what these public schools are, as they're going through this process, where they end up kind of along that spectrum.
All right. Tom, thanks for joining us and talking about this fascinating issue, and I'm sure we'll keep up with you on it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Joining us now is Tanya Reagan, who is a real estate developer in downtown Dallas. Tanya, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So how did you become sort of this downtown activist, especially focused on crime and development downtown?
You know, it's really interesting. It just sort of happened. I purchased a property in downtown Dallas in 2007, and I was new to downtown, and I was doing some projects in Fort Worth, in Tarrant County, and I had an individual that I was working with on purchasing some property in Fort Worth, and they had a parcel in downtown that they were interested in selling. And I ended up buying that property and the property next door. And sort of that was my entryway into downtown. And what got me involved was I purchased the property, and about 6 months after I purchased the property, the Bridge Homeless Shelter actually opened down the street from that property. And, you know, things changed very, very, very fast for me and for the neighborhood after that happened. So that is what originally got me involved in downtown and safety and, you know, working with the neighborhoods to revitalize and improve their environment.
How has downtown changed as far as safety goes since you've gotten here?
You know, it's been really interesting to be involved. I've seen so much. You know, back in 2007 and early 2000s, there were 700 residents that lived downtown. There were really no residents in the farmers market. And, you know, we at that time, as business owners and property owners, we were just trying to protect our investment. You know, we had families that were multi-generational that had been in the wholesale business or the produce business or in some other business that they had been in those neighborhoods for a long time. You know, they had 12-foot fences with barbed wire around their property. And, you know, we were just trying to maintain our investment and, you know, we were worried about theft and vandalism and, you know, really just trying to protect, you know, our businesses and our investments. You know, again, no residents. You flash forward 10 years, it's amazing. You know, today we have 10,000 residents downtown. The farmers market in the next 18 months, farmers market alone will represent a third of the entire downtown population. 10 years ago, we had no residents. I mean, it's been really, really incredible to see the change. It's really exciting. You know, I feel very fortunate to be a part of it, to have been a part of it, and to seen those changes happen. But it's really been a lot of hard work.
Is downtown safe now, do you think?
You know, downtown has some really difficult challenges. You know, today we have these residents moving downtown. We have businesses, local businesses moving downtown. You know, these businesses are investing in our town. That's great. The challenge is, you know, several years ago, downtown was a ghost town after 5 p.m. You know, as I mentioned, we had no residents. So after 5 p.m., you know, the quality of life issues, the crime issues, the things that happen on the street. You know, we didn't have any police coverage after, you know, 10 p.m. at night. There was no evening, early morning coverage. You know, so there was sort of this attitude that after 5 o'clock, the streets were vacant, the streets were dark, and, you know, it was sort of the rules of the street, if you will. You know, you flash forward today, what's changed so much is we've got people. We've got people that are moving on the street, that are walking down the street to go to a restaurant, that are out exercising, that are walking their dog, that are visiting with their neighbors. And, you know, it's really caused the quality of life concerns and some of the safety concerns to really come to a head. Those concerns have always been there, and they have been something that we have struggled with downtown since for as long as I've been here. And a lot of those challenges, quite honestly, people didn't want to talk about. I mean, it's not fun to talk about you know, the things going on with your building. You know, it's not fun to talk about graffiti and people going to the bathroom and vandalism and theft. And, you know, those are not good topics. You know, the quality of life, you know, people sleeping on the street and loitering and, you know, drug activity and miscellaneous other things that are going on. You know, those are not desirable things to talk about. So, you know, in the past, people just didn't really talk about it. Or the neighborhoods that were trying to talk about it and really sort of organizing, sort of a crime watch, if you will, organizing and becoming, you know, involved with activism to try to push for change and to revitalize these areas, you know, it was just really difficult to get support from the city and from the police.
What can be done to make downtown safer?
Well, I think a start is a strong police presence. I think that we are getting there with the addition of the First Watch police. We are the only major city.
And First Watch is the early morning hours that you were talking about that aren't policed within the Central Business District.
That's correct. First Watch is the late evening, early morning hours police coverage in Central Business District. In the past, we have not had any coverage during that time. We are the only major city in Texas without 24-hour coverage in their Central Business District. Originally, the First Watch was going to be added in January. Chief Brown has actually moved that ahead. Starting December 2nd, we will have 24/7 coverage in Central Business District. That's a start. Something else that can be done is foot patrol. You know, with the increased number of residents and people moving on the street, we need more officers that are engaged with the community, engaged with the public, and physically moving on the street, walking around. We also need stronger enforcement of some of our laws. You know, things such as panhandling, sleeping in public, you know, loitering, you know, things that have maybe have been ignored in the past. You know, today, with trying to create economic development and encourage people to move downtown, we need to take some of those things on head on, and we have to really work hard to enforce some of those laws. We need cooperation with some of our big businesses like 7-Eleven. 7-Eleven has a big footprint downtown. They're trying to open more locations, acquire more land. We need to work with companies like 7-Eleven to, you know, do a better job with security and safety for their customers that are entering their store. Things like DART, you know, DART police and the DART station. You know, those are areas that are very common to have criminal activity and large amounts of people gathering. We need the DART to work closely with the police to have a approach to deal with some of the street behaviors and some of the laws.
Obviously, adding the First Watch was a big step, but
huge.
But with police, you know, they are dealing with a bit of a manpower issue. They're dealing with the high response times for 911. They've been losing on the net officers each year. What are they telling you in terms of being able to meet the I guess demands of living in an urban environment and keeping that safe?
You know, the police are in a tough position. You know, obviously, you know, they have to deal with a lot right now. You know, we are very pro-police. You know, you've got a lot of officers that have been downtown a long time. They don't necessarily live in Dallas. And some of them don't completely understand the changes that are taking place. They see more people moving in. But, you know, to some of them, it doesn't look a lot different today than it did 5 years ago. The police are under a lot of pressure with the environment today that they have to be very careful. Some of them are concerned to enforce some of the laws because of, you know, concerns for backlash. You know, we have an officer over in Deep Elm, Jesus Martinez, and you know, he was very involved with the neighborhood. I'm sure you're familiar with him.
Right.
You know, had a tremendous amount of community support, had done a lot for the neighborhood. You know, he was in a position that you know, that something happened on the street and, You know, it took several months, I think a little over a year, to work through all that. He did end up getting his job back. He's back on the street. But situations like that make it very, very difficult for police dealing with the homeless, dealing with the panhandling, dealing with some of the mental illness. You know, they have to make split-second decisions. And, you know, they, I think, sometimes feel that they are, their hands are tied somewhat in some of the enforcement.
All right. And one more thing before we go. What do you aim to be exactly for downtown? Are you more Jane Jacobs? Are you like Avi Edelman, the barking dog of downtown? You're shaking your head no on that one. What do you see yourself as when you're pushing all this this stuff about safety and downtown development?
Well, I can tell you, you know, I started a blog called The Dallas Urbanista, and sort of what was behind that is, you know, I live downtown, I work downtown, I play downtown. This is my 24/7 environment. My office is downtown. I own real estate throughout downtown. And, you know, I have made not only this my home and my investment, but this is my community. I go out in Deep Elm. You know, I eat lunch over at Ellen's in West End. You know, this is my home. And, you know, I don't think I'm really trying to be anything other than, you know, really trying to make downtown a great place to be. And it's been such a wild experience. When we started in the farmers market and we sort of organized, we were such a small group of people. And, you know, we've sort of grown into this organization that is we're very organized. We work very closely with the city, with the city council, you know, with the county. We're very involved with a lot of initiatives going downtown. That sort of expanded into a coalition. You know, we formed a coalition with Cedars, Deep Elm, and Farmers Market. Been extremely successful. It's allowed multiple neighborhoods to work together to sort of have a best practices to deal with some of the quality of life, safety, economic development issues. And, you know, it's just sort of evolved from there. And I think more than anything, you know, I just want to be a part of the change. And, you know, I really feel like that's happening.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. And
thank you so much for your time and the invitation.
All right. Tanya Reagan. So, Kevin, you reported a story this week on a bit of a wrinkle to child porn laws. Inmates who were in prison drawing comics of child pornography. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, exactly. There were two men in the Segalville prison here in North Texas in the federal prison serving time for child pornography convictions who got a hold of child porn comics. And they are Danny Borgos and John Farrar. And one of them said that he actually got the comics from another inmate who drew it for him. And the inmate said that he was going to provide him some more. And just like any population, some people are going to have artistic talents. And when you're behind bars, you want to use those talents for whatever advantage you can get. And I'm sure that some of these artists were selling their comics, their obscene child pornography comics, for some sort of gain, whether it was cigarettes or some other contraband. And so the Bureau of Prisons caught them with it. And so they are now charged with another federal crime, which is a 2003 obscenity law, which made it illegal to possess obscene depictions of children engaged in sex.
So this raises an interesting question in that with normal child pornography, there are victims. There are children who have been victimized, whether it's by the person who possesses it or, you know, through reproduction of those images. In this case, it's just someone drawing something. That sort of seems to raise some First Amendment issues at the same time.
Yeah. And in fact, there have been previous cases involving this where defense attorneys have raised that actual defense, saying that these are not real people. No one is harmed and laws should be passed to prevent harm. But in fact, this 2003 law points out that this is an obscenity law. So there don't have to be any actual people involved. The law covers any visual depictions of children having sex, including drawings, cartoons, sculptures, or paintings, if they are shown to be obscene. And the government has the burden of proving that the material lacks serious scientific, literary, artistic, or political value. And it's up to a jury to decide whether it is, in fact, obscene. And the law carries a punishment that's equal to possession of actual child pornography.
What's their argument that they should be allowed to have that? I mean, the sympathy for me is just not there for these people.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, they claim First Amendment for example, there was a person from, I believe it was Virginia, who was caught with Japanese manga, a manga comic book, which is very popular in Japan. But this particular book had children being sexually abused by adults. And the defense attorney tried to argue that it was made by professional artists in Japan and that it had some value. The jury in the case ultimately decided that no, there is no First Amendment protection for obscene material.
Naomi, this week we had another person arrested in St. Louis, Missouri, who was from Dallas, arrested for butt injections. This is a story that captured a lot of people's, I guess, imagination in this case. When there were two people arrested in Dallas for allegedly killing someone by giving them butt injections.
So basically, these illegal butt injections usually involve silicone from a hardware store or other places that are on the black market and not from a doctor or medical supply company. And basically, what happened over the summer was, so we had this death in Deep Ellum in February, a woman who had, you know, worked as a home health nurse and, you know, wanted a larger butt, went to this salon in Deep Ellum and got the injections, died on the table, and the two people accused of performing the injections fled the scene. So the cops got there and saw her body. So they were both arrested, the two suspects, and were out on bond. And then over the summer, I got a call from a woman in St. Louis area, and she said her niece was dying in the hospital. She was a dancer, an exotic dancer in St. Louis, by the name of Daisha Phillips, 22 years old, and that she believed the woman from Dallas, who goes by the name Wee Wee, but her real name is Denise Ross, was somehow involved. She had a phone number to this woman, and she provided it to us. The number on public records came back to Denise Ross. So we were immediately interested. I called the police department there, and they said they were investigating whether Wee Wee was actually the suspect. They believed it was at the time. So yesterday, we had a new development in the case where they issued an arrest warrant for another Dallas woman, not Wee Wee, but another woman whose name is Natika Lee. And she's 44, around the same age as Wee Wee. We're still not clear on whether they know each other or what the connection there is, but the police are still investigating that. And she is from Dallas. And so it just appears that Dallas seems to have, is kind of known among these dancers. We've been told by dancers that Dallas and Atlanta are kind of two of these epicenters of butt injections for people looking to enhance their butts and hips.
And Naomi, do these people who are providing this procedure, do they have any medical background or training at all?
No, and actually a lot of them are criminals. I mean, ex-cons, or they've done jail time. Natika Lee, the woman who was wanted in St. Louis, who's from Dallas, she did 5 years for robbery and burglary in Texas. Denise Ross also had a history of criminal convictions. So these people do not go to med school to be it's an understatement, basically. You know, they learn this on the streets a lot of the time. But they do tell their customers that, you know, I learned this from a doctor, or I learned this from someone with medical training. Like they're known to exaggerate these claims, and it's kind of unclear where they learn this. But it is extremely dangerous, and a lot of the medical people that we've talked to have said that it's extremely easy to die from this, because what happens is they could inject it by accident. So they're trying to inject it between your fat and your muscle to kind of get, you know, more fat in there. What happens is they could easily inject it into directly your veins, and then it would travel through your bloodstream and get caught into your lungs, and that's what kills them pretty much instantly. Sometimes they can hang on life support for a few days, but that's what's been the case around the country. There's been a lot of these deaths.
I would never trust a doctor named Dr. Wee Wee, but could you, are there anyone who are like satisfied customers? Have you ever talked to someone who's been happy with their procedure?
A whole bunch of them. I mean, and that's what's so controversial about this is that in the dancer community and the transgender community, where you have men trying to become women and wanting that fuller shape, and dancers who want to make more money and they want, you know, their butts to be bigger. They defend these women who, or, you know, people who are caught doing this. They're like, you know, they're helping us. They're doing the service that we can't afford to go to a plastic surgeon and get $13,000 worth of enhancements. We only have a couple hundred bucks, you know, and so they defend them. And I, when Wee-Wee first got arrested in February, I spoke to two of her clients who said that she helped them and she made them feel better about themselves, and they knew the risks going in. They knew she wasn't a doctor. They kind of laughed at the idea that someone would think she was a doctor.
It sounds like they're taking advantage of people who can't afford to go to an actual doctor and are kind of desperate to get this procedure done.
And that's one of the issues, is that these people are usually on the margins of society, you know, strippers, prostitutes, transgender women. They don't have a lot of money. They don't, you know, they don't have a lot of resources, and they don't have a lot of advocates or people in society. So they are kind of being taken advantage of in a way. At least that's the view that a lot of people who work with them say. So it's definitely an issue, and there hasn't been a big effort by law enforcement to really crack down on it, because it's so in the shadows and it's on the margins of society that it doesn't seem to sort of rise to the level of people of law enforcement, like creating a unit or something to tackle this.
Maybe if Kim Kardashian has a bad procedure, then we'll get some movement on it.
And, you know, that's one of the main women who these customers ask for, is that I want to look like Kim Kardashian or Nicki Minaj, who have very exaggerated behinds, possibly surgically enhanced, but, you know, definitely not from someone who does it in the back door of a salon or a hotel room.
We'll have a new Hashing It Out with Mike Hashimoto next, but before we go, we have a programming note. Next week is Thanksgiving, and we will have a show. It will be a special episode about cold cases. Our colleagues Tasha Chaparis and Julie Fancher will host, and they'll interview Dallas Police Detective Eddie Ibarra and Homicide Sergeant Joe Garza. Our producer and sound engineer today is Brian Elledge. Thanks again to Tanya Reagan and Austin Bureau reporter Tom Benning. For Naomi Martin and Kevin Krause, I'm Tristan Hallman. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
How do you rate your city's police department? Crime stats are one imperfect way. Another is response times, or how long does it take to get a cop to your personal crime scene. The catch-22? It does no good to tell a politician that zero isn't a reasonable expectation. In recent years, the numbers in Dallas have reached historic lows. In some cases, as in murders, lows not seen since the 1950s. Great news, except for the flip side. The lower the crime rate, the more city politicians see police spending as a place to cut. Yes, Dallas police should constantly evaluate how they use their personnel they have. Public safety spending already takes up more than half the city's budget, and Police Chief David Brown wants more. Here's a hard truth. Brown has fewer sworn officers than he had when he took over in 2010. The city no longer hires more officers than it loses through attrition. In fact, it has committed to hire fewer in recent budget cycles. Response times get longer, violent crime rates go up. If the city population grows while the police population shrinks, what do you expect? Dallas City Council members must decide if that trite doing more with less thing really makes sense for their police department, or one day voters will decide for them.